Bruce is better than that. This is my regular speed.
Okay, so I am here with Deb Olin-Unferth, who's most recently the author of Revolution. Deb, how are you doing?
I'm great. Thanks for having me.
This nonfiction volume contains almost echoes of your fiction. The trip to Nicaragua, of course, is very much a part of Vacation, which also deals with the distinction between tourist and traveler, the sort of Bowles-like distinction. It's almost memorialized a second time with this, and I'm wondering to what degree in exploring some of these aspects in your life that nonfiction almost feels truer than fiction, or does fiction feel truer?
Well, I mean, I would say that the thing is that I always wanted to write this particular book.
Oh, yeah.
And so I was sort of working on it all of these years, for many, many years, but I didn't really know what kind of form it was going to take. So I kept writing. Like, one time I wrote it as a murder mystery that took place in the 80s.
Really?
In
a
El
murder
Salvador.
Mystery?
Yeah, like, sort of a crime novel.
Huh.
And then one time I wrote it as a series of essays. And that's one time I went back to Central America and I found all these old priests that I had actually known back in the 80s. And
yeah.
I looked for them and I interviewed them, and I was going to write these essays about the state of liberation theology 10 years later,
yeah.
20 years later, whatever. And that was a complete disaster because I don't know how to do anything like that.
So you had almost a philosophical effort to get into this particular story almost.
Yeah.
Instead of an experiential one, which this book essentially is.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And then I had so many failed efforts that I just decided I'm not going to work on this book anymore. Forget it. It's over. I'm never going to write about Central America again.
Yeah.
And then I wrote Vacation.
Yes.
And then people said, hey, you finally finished that Nicaragua book.
Yeah.
And I was like, no, it's the Brooklyn book.
Yeah.
And so then I realized that I really needed to go ahead and write the book. So that's probably why you see echoes of it, of this particular trip in most of my work.
Is this a recurrent situation? Like, for example, the early stories were, to some degree, a kind of warm-up for tackling these themes with a greater sense of fleshing things out in Vacation, and that this is almost the sort of like, okay, now that I've actually lived the life, now that I've actually come to terms from a textual standpoint, I can really start to create this memorialized document. Is something like that how things worked here? Or?
Yeah, I think so. Or maybe, I mean, one time someone told me that my book seems to be, or my work in general seems to be about moving, about movement, travel, going from place to place. And so if you look at a lot of my work that way, including Vacation, including
yeah.
a lot of my stories that were in Minor Robberies and other work, then this is just sort of another form of that same material. So like I wrote stories, and then I wrote a novel, then I wrote a memoir, and they're all kind of dealing with these similar themes
yeah.
in some way, maybe.
You write that in 1987, Nicaragua had the most promising revolution of the time. What were the key qualities that you were looking for in a revolution? Did you require violence? Did you require Marxism? Was it really just a matter of being able to ride the bus there? What was the exact nature? I didn't quite get that from the book, but I was really curious.
Well, the idea is that a revolution is really a revolution when it's won. Before it's been won, it's called things like civil wars or uprisings or, you know, things like that. So the fact is that the Nicaraguans had taken over, the Sandinistas had taken over the country in 1979 and run out the dictators. So then they had, then they took over the government and they established a new revolutionary government. So it was the most promising revolution to us because they actually had a real revolutionary government that
yeah.
we could take part in, and they were socialists, which was a very big philosophy and political stance at the time. It was,
yes.
Which it isn't
and
anymore.
There are some people who still believe that it's a influential stance, although, you know, not as successful as they were in the 80s when it was revolution here, revolution there. As an interviewer, I feel compelled to ask why you felt taping the people was the best way of understanding them. You described this bundle of tapes, and later you were actually stopped because of these particular tapes. Thankfully, they weren't actually played. But it is rather curious that recording these stories seem to be the best way for you to try to understand them. Why do you think that was?
That's a good question. I think it was that we felt that maybe the tapes would, we would be able to go back and listen to the tapes later, that the tapes would be useful in some way at a later date, that we felt that that we could understand the people we were interviewing better if we were, and have opportunities to meet them if we had a tape recorder and we're saying, you know, we're asking questions. I don't know. I could ask you the same question. Why do you feel it's important to
That's a good question. Well, to my mind, in some vague way, I'm perhaps would like to, and this almost sounds hubristic, even though I don't mean it as such, I would like to think that I'm recording some history of some kind that, let's say, in 10 years, you, Deb, produce, like, your masterpiece, and we can go back 10 years before and see, well, what were you thinking before these germinations, these three books leading up to what ended up being an even bigger book. Well, there's the trajectory right there. It's also why I like to talk to people multiple times. I've talked to T.C. Boyle now 4 times, and even then I find that he's a little bit different each time. So, you know, maybe history was perhaps the draw for you at a very young age? Or?
Yeah, well, I mean, if I think about you and what you do, I mean, it seems like you're also kind of recording the echoes of contemporary culture in a lot of ways.
Yes,
so
that's
very true.
So
you are getting, like, because, you know, you interview quite a few people, so you're getting sort of a wide swath of, you know, contemporary letters and what are people thinking about in contemporary letters at this time.
Yes.
And so I would say that's a similar thing to what we were trying to do, just sort of, you know, establish the tone and the concerns of liberation theologians and people who were involved in these revolutions at the time.
We have to capture the present moment in an effort to see it differently 5 years from now, or 10 years from now, or 20 years from now.
It's true,
Does text for you serve the same function, or a similar function, or is it a little bit different by coming at it from memory, from research, from your notebooks at the time, I presume? You allude to those in the book. What is the effort of this cycle for you? What is the ultimate purpose, I guess? That's a very general question, but since we're talking about this.
The ultimate purpose of writing Revolution?
Yes, exactly.
Well, I mean, it felt like an urgent thing to do.
Yeah.
It felt like I really, really wanted to write it, which is also how it felt with Vacation and Minor Robberies.
Yeah.
And hasn't felt that way about, I haven't felt that way about many other things in my life. So, I mean, so I would say that's the primary thing. It's sort of personal urgency.
Yeah.
And then, and just sort of a desire to untangle whatever questions were being asked for myself. But then if I look at it in a sort of broader, like what place does this book have? I think that I really wanted it to contribute to the conversation about memoirs was one thing. I wanted to be thinking about what a memoir is, and I wanted to expand that a little bit. I wanted to do something a little different than most memoirists, because I feel like memoir is such an interesting form.
Yeah.
And then I wanted to write a coming-of-age story that isn't quite as simple as, you know, something is learned and then someone grows as a result of it. I mean, I think that there's so many different ways to approach coming-of-age story. And so in this one, it's almost like someone becomes slowly disillusioned, and that's how... And that's how the coming of age is accomplished in some way. So I think that was part of it. And then also I think my continued fascination with the country, with those countries, especially Nicaragua, and just the sheer Nicaragua to me just seems like such a fascinating place, and El Salvador, both just fascinating places. And there were these people who did these incredibly courageous things, and developed whole philosophies and risked their lives and all these things. And now we've just forgotten about it.
Sure.
And I find that to be so heartbreaking. And I haven't forgotten, so I want to talk about it.
Well, to go back to what you were saying at the beginning of that answer about this sense of urgency, it is very interesting to me that you have chosen perhaps the least urgent of all mediums, the book, which takes a long time to write, which then has to go through editing, which then has to sit in dry dock for 2 years before it's published. And then here you are 2 years later talking about something, and we're not talking about the urgent moment. This is the difficulty, I suppose, of some of these conversations, because you're probably working on something else right now. And yet, that spirit of urgency is what was the guiding principle of this particular project. Why try urgency in such a slow burn medium?
Because my moments of urgency last a long time.
Uh-huh. So it's lasting urgency, you see.
Yeah. I mean, it's not that my urgencies aren't something that kind of sweep in on me and then last for a moment and then flee. They just sit inside me for a long time.
So for you, some of your very taut paragraphs, your one-sentence paragraphs, they're almost an attempt to capture a lasting urgency, and then the ephemeral urgencies don't actually make it into your book. Would that be safe to say, or?
My ephemeral, what do you mean by ephemeral urgency?
Well, like, urgencies? You know, obviously you're not, would you say that all of your urgency is lasting, or is some of it ephemeral?
Oh, no, some are, I mean, I guess in many ways, we're all sort of a bundle of urgencies,
yeah.
Right? We're all trying to do all kinds of things to stay calm, to try to stay calm. And some of those things are satisfied very easily just by eating something if I'm hungry or something. And then others feel sort of deep and existential and possibly without solution.
Yeah.
So there are many different levels of urgencies, I suppose.
When your urgency is captured into text, is it less urgent, or does it still last?
Maybe it feels less urgent once it's sort of done and out there. Like this particular topic doesn't, now that it's written and the thing is done and the book is out, I don't feel as urgent about that topic anymore.
Yeah. We were mentioning Nicaragua earlier. I feel that we should also mention El Salvador, which is also in this book. The Farabundo Marti National Liberation Front, which factors in, is now a legitimate party in 1992. Of course, there was the peace accords. And I'm wondering if there was any part of your younger self that possibly could have stayed on around that time and perhaps revolutionized your way into legitimacy like that.
You know, the person who I was couldn't have done that because
yeah.
I was, I didn't really know what I was getting into. And once I was there, what I saw was very scary and I wasn't used to being afraid. So I personally don't think that I could have stayed on and been legitimate, but I think that George could have for sure.
Yeah.
And I think that other people could have and probably did, and did, for sure.
Yeah.
So.
But you did flit around a lot, at least as you depict yourself in this book. I mean, what do you think was the ultimate lasting existing point during this part of your life, and how can a book, I suppose, I mean, also, going back to the subject of lasting urgency, how can you capture a lasting urgency from 20 years ago? Has some of this urgency by now dissipated, or do you still hold on to much of this lasting urgency? Or was the book in some way a way to recapture the lasting urgency, creating a new lasting urgency to replace the old lasting urgency? A lot to throw at you, I know, but what of this?
I think that I still had, the reason that it still felt urgent was that there were still all these questions that I had
about
about Central America and about myself and about George. And I felt, and so the urgency was sustained in that way over the years. And it didn't seem to get any better.
Yeah.
It seemed as if, I mean, I feel like whatever it is that you do when you're 18 years old is really important and very formative, and is probably going to be with you for a really long time. Like, do you remember what you were doing? What were you doing when you were 18?
I do remember what I was doing when I was 18. I was in a band that was going nowhere. I was making these silly little films. And I suppose, like you, trying to find a form of myself that I later... that later came into fruition maybe about 10 years later, except I didn't know it. I mean, it was probably something similar, I would guess, to you, at least based off of reading this book.
Yeah, I mean, I think that when you're 18, it's your first time that you're taking control of your own self. You know, you're harnessing your creative energy, you're making decisions for yourself. You know, you could... it's your first time that you're not being told what to do every minute, like you're not in high school anymore. And So it feels very formative. Whatever decisions you're making at that time, you're going to feel the reverberations of that for a long time. And you're probably going to scold yourself for being so stupid. And you're probably also going to think of that self sentimentally, or, you know, there's all kinds of things that you can feel for it. But you'll probably have a relationship to it that feels important in some way.
But it is interesting that level of confusion when you were young. I mean, it's there, but like, for example, you describe the leers and the sort of groping of these men late in the book. And that whole section is really a very minute portion of the book. And yet, you describe that I felt trepidation every time this happened. And that to me is sort of shows the risk of trying to recapture a feeling that was there all along through a long stretch of it, but is unfortunately in book form confined to that one paragraph, which makes me wonder whether the memoir can even account for these for the development of an earlier self. What do you think about this? Do you think that did you make an effort to try to delve into this further, or did it just seem that the paragraph that describes all of it, is that pretty much the only way you can come to terms with it in text?
You know, it's interesting because that particular aspect of the trip about the men, it still stays with me. I mean, it was so intense. And at different writings of the book, it played a stronger part. But I resisted writing more about it because I took most of it out.
Yeah.
Because I didn't want the book to be about me as victim of these men.
Yeah.
Although I was.
Yeah.
Definitely. I mean, the thing is, there's so much that I didn't put in there about these, you know, these men who were just constantly bothering me and in many different ways. And I left almost all of it out. It was just a choice that I made. I feel like it is an absence in there, but it would have changed the book pretty drastically.
Or perhaps this relationship with men was there with George and your father. I mean, you do cop at one point. You say, what kind of a man who's about to marry me takes me out in the middle of nowhere, takes me to this kind of place? So I think maybe that is a more accurate connection with the way you are now, because there seems to me in this book a very dire sense of wanting to connect your younger self with your present self. And was this, I suppose, some of the criteria as to what you included in, or to the degree to which you wrote about something like, you know, being degraded by these men, or you know, or walking around the room in your underwear, which was a very funny little moment too, that any moment you wrote about had to almost be part of who you are now to some degree?
Well, I mean, I see what you mean.
Yeah.
And maybe I did that unconsciously or something, but I feel like the part about the violence of men in that country, in those countries, I feel like that was a deliberate omission, very deliberate, because I didn't want the book to be about that. And I tried to allude to the fact that it was a bigger problem than I was making it out to be. Like, I said something about how I was angry about it all the time. And I said something, and I make little references to, for instance, I briefly mentioned how a man snuck into my room in the middle of the night and I had to smash him over the head with a bottle.
Yeah.
You know, so I make little references to these things so that you know that these things were happening, but I didn't, it had nothing to do with it isn't that, the reason that I didn't write about it isn't because it doesn't have anything to do with who I am now. That's not why I didn't write about it. I didn't write about it because I made a choice about what I was willing to reveal and what I wasn't willing to reveal.
Well, clearly your choice caused it to nevertheless stick in this reader's head.
I
couldn't help but think about this all the time when reading your book. But this does lead me to ask you if the sort of comic tone of the book might have also been one of the considerations as to why such a thing was not left out, but kind of cut down. There's one thing I wanted to talk to you about. You observe at one point that two bad boat tails must be balanced by one good boat tail, so say sailors. And this is followed by a parenthetical statement where you write, "Do sailors say that? I don't know. I've never known a sailor." So, you know, the thing that's funny about this is that it's almost as if you don't have confidence in any form of adage, whether it is something you hear, something you devise. Is this intended to, I suppose, relate to this folly of, like, well, or this confusion of this younger time, or is it just a simple comic aside?
Well, one thing that I wanted to say about the other question that I just thought of is that about humor, is that one of my models for the book was Gertrude Stein's autobiography. Autobiography of Alice B. Toklas.
Got it.
And in there's a chapter called The War, mm-hmm. where and it's about World War I, and it's about when Gertrude and Alice bought a car and became ambulance drivers.
Yes.
All around France. And it's so unbelievably funny and dark and strange. And when I read that chapter years ago, I thought, oh my, this is how I can write this book. And so when you ask about the men, it's really interesting to me, because here they were in the middle of this war, and there are hints that there are these really dark, scary things happening, really upsetting, you know, things she's seeing that are going to haunt her forever, or, you know, situations that are so grim and intense that, you know, so that they are truly disturbing. And so there are these hints all over the place and brief mentions of them, but there's a sort of a sheen of humor and over all of it, and so that to me then the dark moments feel all the more poignant because of it. And so I think that's kind of what I was trying to do a little bit.
That comedy limbs the truth of the tragedy, or causes you to reflect on something that's truly dark, that if you were just to be straight, declarative, and humorless, it wouldn't necessarily make as much of an impact, at least in this context?
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
Oh, okay.
And then what you said about that joke about the sailors.
Yeah.
You know, I think I put on that "so say sailors" part because of the sounds, "so say sailors."
Yeah.
You know, it's the three S's, and it just, doesn't that sound nice together, "so say sailors"?
It does, but it also serves as this attempt at authenticity that is, and then the rug is completely slipped up with the parenthetical right
there. I thought that was funny.
Yeah,
like, I put that in because it sounded nice, you know, "so say sailors," and then I was thinking, but I really don't know if that's what sailors say. So
So
I just put that in there because I think that, you know, language and sound, you know, influences so much of what I write.
Yeah.
So
much of these associations came from just wanting to find a rhythm or a particular series of sounds that was pleasurable in constructing the sentences.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah.
Of 1987... you write, "In those days, you could run away and it meant something." Now, this is interesting not only because Myers runs away in Vacation, but also because you observe in an earlier chapter that you still have a fear of being left. I do know that you were repeatedly rejected for McSweeties until finally they accepted one story and asked for a manuscript and all that. Dave Eggers gave you a hand, sent you a handwritten note. But if you have an abandonment issue, and if you still have an abandonment issue, well, here's this profession, writing, which is all about being ignored, all about being rejected, all about being shit on if you have any voice that is unique or that is interesting. Additionally, I'm wondering if you have tried efforts to run away in the years since, and if so, did any of these escapes mean anything to you, and what of this idea of attempting to subsist in an occupation or a vocation that is actually at odds with this anxiety of being left?
It's true. It's so sad. Being a writer is so horrible. It really is. You know, I remember before I was serious. I mean, when I was pretty serious about writing right away. But before I was many years into it, I would read interviews with other writers, or I would talk to other writers who would say, "It's really pretty horrible. I mean, you really don't want to do this." And I remember thinking that they were kind of putting it on, you know, like, you know, being maybe a little precious about the whole thing. But now I understand. It really is pretty awful. It's, you know, the rejections come for the individual stories, and then the book gets rejected, and then the bad reviews start coming in. I mean, it just sort of goes on and on. I don't know why now the publishing industry is sort of falling apart. I don't know. It's a grim scene. It's a grim scene, man. But so far I'm still doing it. I mean, yeah, so far I'm still doing it. And then your other question was about...
Well, it was a big jumble, but it was basically the idea about being left while also wondering if you could, in fact, escape in some sense or flee in some sense or run away and have it mean something.
I have done that in more recent years. Yeah. And it does mean something, for sure. I mean, when I wrote Vacation, it was coming directly out of a fleeing that I was partaking in at that moment.
Really?
Yeah, and that's how that book came to be.
The husband that you allude to in this book, I presume. Yeah, okay. Well, I won't report what your head just did, so I'll just leave it at that. But if that's the case, well, it would seem to me that much of your fiction is serving the same purpose as this memoir, which is about chronicling these feelings or trying to get at something that this lasting urgency that you feel, but that you wonder if you're going to be able to capture in text or in a sentence, while simultaneously dealing with, oh, does it sound right? And simultaneously dealing with, well, will anybody be interested in this? Since your initial lasting urgency has to go through so many hoops and through so many prisms, through so many filters, you seem fairly well adjusted sitting before me. But I'm curious how you if you agonize over this, or what do you, to what degree you do?
I do agonize over it. I feel writing to be very fulfilling usually. Maybe not at this particular moment in time, but generally I find it to be really fulfilling. I find it to be very meditative. I find it gives a lot of structure and meaning to my life. So that's why I keep doing it. And because I sort of believe in that expression of morality. Like, it seems to me that these are moral tales that help us figure out how to live our lives, and I think I believe in that kind of expression. I believe in these kinds of narratives to help me figure out how to live, as opposed to many other narratives that I have encountered. This one seems to me to really work, at least in my life. So that's kind of maybe why I keep at it. Also, I have this belief in the unique voice, that I feel like we each have this unique sound that we can make, and I want to make that sound and record that sound as best I can. I mean, some people do it in different ways. You know, some people do it maybe by making their own baby that will make, hopefully make their sounds for them, or by
literally an act of creation.
Right, exactly. Or by you know, writing music, or you know, different things like that. And this is mine, and I just want it to be as honest as possible. Like, I don't want there to be any bullshit in there.
Yeah.
So even when I put in the things like So Say Sailors, that sounds just like a playful aside, but that's my sound speaking. That's like the most honest way that I have of expressing myself, is putting in that So Say Sailors and then questioning it. It's like, it's part of like, it's like a recording of my mind, the way that I give and take away. Like, I say something in my mind, and then I'm immediately contradicting it, or I'm saying something in my mind because I like the way that it sounds, and then I'm immediately responding to it with a different sound. So
yes.
it's a recording of what's inside of me, and yeah.
The book is almost an evolution of the recorded tape you made of talking to somebody, of trying to capture their unique voices. This leads me to wonder if, as a child, this sounds very psychoanalytical, but as a child, Deb, did you make any preliminary efforts to capture your unique voice or another's unique voice in an effort to come to terms with what seems to me the truth of the lasting urgency?
Not really. Yeah. I don't think so. I mean, I didn't decide to become a writer until I was 25, so I was pretty late, very late. However, this woman contacted me on Facebook, who had known me when I was in third or fourth grade or something, and she said that I used to write stories.
Yeah.
And she said that she was my age, you know, we were playmates, and she said that that I would even say that I couldn't come out and play a lot. I often would say this because I needed to work on my book, is what I would actually tell her. And I have no memory of this, and I am amazed, because that's exactly what I say all the time now. It's almost, I was so shocked when she said that, because she doesn't know me now, so she has no idea that that's what I say all the time.
Yeah.
And so I was shocked that she said that. So maybe I was, maybe, you know.
So if certain truths and certain memories are not so easily accessed, this must make the memoir a very difficult place for you to capture the lasting urgency. I mean, how much of your memory as an 18-year-old did you have, or was that aspect clearer than, say, the sort of excuses you were making in third grade of staying inside doing these stories?
Well, I wouldn't be able to recapture that 18-year-old mind now.
Yeah.
The only reason I was able to is that, first of all, I kept all these old journals, so
yeah.
I have a record of the things that I was thinking about. And I lifted a lot of lines directly out of the journals and put them into the book. And then also, as soon as I started writing at 25, I was writing stories from this book that appear, a lot of them almost verbatim. Like, for example, that chapter called Peanut Butter.
Yeah.
Which, there's a lot of dialogue in that chapter. So you would think, you know, how in the world could you remember? She's just making all of that up. But actually, that was one of the first stories I ever wrote, was that, and I tried to write it down exactly as I remembered it. When I was 25 years old, I wrote it. And then I just saved it all these years, and I thought it would just be like a story, but the story didn't make a lot of sense unless you knew everything about what was going on in Nicaragua at that time. So I never published it. I just let it sit around, and then when I finally was writing the memoir, then I pulled it out, and I was like, oh my God, I remember this so well. And so all I really did to it was just kind of neaten it up a little bit, and I took out a few things, and I just stuck it right in there. So that's kind of how the whole book is, really. I mean, there's not that much that I recreated from my 18-year-old mind.
Huh. Do you worry about any questions of authenticity, or do you just accept the notebooks over, say, what you remember? I mean, were there any competing memories between what you wrote down and what you remember while you were coming to terms with this for the book? Or
There were, and I tried to just write that right into the book.
Oh, yeah.
Like, there's a chapter in there called La Prensa, where maybe you remember where I have, I'm talking about this experience of getting the first issue of La Prensa that had at the censored newspaper that was allowed to reopen. And then I say, oh, but maybe it wasn't like that at all. Maybe we weren't the first. And in fact, maybe it was hadn't reopened at all. And, you know, so I go through all of the different permutations of my memory and of what I see in what I read about in books and in documentation that contrasts with my memory. So
that uncertainty is, to my mind, one of the reasons why the book maintains its comic tone. And it leads me to wonder if the competing memories, the competing notions of what you lived, at what point during the stage of writing this did you realize, oh, well, this is absolutely going to be a driving force of the book?
Well, I think that all along it was,
yeah.
Because I know, because, look at that, there's a guy taking pictures of us.
Yes.
Hello.
Wow, I've never had that happen.
He took a bunch. He was standing over there and then over there. Anyway.
Wait, was that the guy who was sitting there?
Yeah.
Because I was going on and talking about meat earlier, and we're in a vegan restaurant, and he was looking at me and giving me a dirty look. So I wonder if
he's probably going to put you in the news.
I hope I haven't incriminated you. Oh,
me?
He was taking a picture of me. That's bizarre.
I think that he's going to put you in the newspaper as a meat eater.
Yeah.
Wow.
No, I don't know what he was saying.
I'm a little weirded out by that, but okay.
Really?
Anyway.
Yeah, that is a little weird.
That was
I don't
weird.
Know. People are always taking pictures in New York.
Yeah, but taking pictures of us, yeah. Anyway,
But you wouldn't have incriminated me because I didn't say. Look at this. This guy was also just leaning over, trying to read your paper.
Yeah. Exactly.
Anyway.
No, well, some guy was taking pictures of us.
There was a guy who was sitting right here?
Yeah.
It was. He was sitting right here.
He went
outside and was taking pictures.
He was giving me a few looks. I don't know. But have you seen that guy before?
No, I didn't wait on that guy.
Oh, okay. Anyway, so we were talking about at what point you knew that the competing memories was a driving force of the book, and you were saying, oh, well, I knew that early on. And then we got distracted by the Mr. Photographer, so.
The competing memories.
I'm sorry.
Oh, I know what I was going to say. Is that one of the reasons that I wanted to write a memoir is because I could explore those very questions.
Yeah.
Because I think that memoir is different from autobiography in that it's not just a statement of facts. It's the exploration of memory, of the foundation of identity, of the problems with memory and with the problems with time and our perception of time. So I feel like memory, like memoir, has to always be in conversation with that. It's a philosophical examination of memory as much as it is a story about a person. So any memoir that doesn't deal with questions of identity, time, and memory is a failure. So I really needed it to be an important part of the book.
I also wanted to ask you, late in the book, when you were trying to track down George in the present, you write, I don't know if I hired the private eye so I could write the book, or if I wrote the book so I could hire the private eye. You say that you need to know that George still existed, that the thing that he is exists, that it's out there somewhere, roaming the earth, creating havoc, growing, possibly multiplying. I'm curious, why this need for corroboration? I mean, why isn't your memory or these notebooks enough? That impulse, that George spirit, is going to be out there regardless of whether George the Schrodinger's cat, whether the state of that is dead or alive. It's still going to exist. So I was really curious about that impulse, why that you needed to know, why you needed to contact him, why you needed to be absolutely in touch with this figure. Or was it legal reasons? I don't know. You tell me.
Well, it was nice to suddenly have the excuse of legal reasons.
Yes.
I was very excited about that.
What did you know it would be a legal reason? It was just like, all of a sudden, we need to clear this with legal, and then you had the overriding need to contact him.
Well, I know for a fact that one of the biggest reasons that I wrote this book was because then I would have a really good excuse to look for George.
Yes.
Because anyone who writes it, and it wasn't just legal reasons, it's also narrative reasons.
Sure,
you know,
sure.
If you write a memoir, then you know you expect to find out what happens to the people, you know, years later. It's almost a requirement. The person has to go on a search for, you know, whatever it is. So I was very excited about that possibility, but I couldn't do it until I'd actually really... It looked like the book was going to be actually a book because I'd tried to write the book so many times and it had never worked at all. So now I had, for the first time, once I knew it was going to be a book, I felt very excited that
yes.
Now I had every right. Nobody could blame me. Nobody could think I was a crazy person or was stalking or any other or was still... longing for the man that I loved when I was 18 or, you
yeah.
know, anything like that. So it was very exciting. It was a very exciting moment.
But if I could write the book, that's a really specific and explicit thing to say. I mean, it's not just a matter of legal reasons or narrative needs. It's a matter of, like, I have to talk with him if this book is going to be true. So, what of this absolutism?
Well, what I meant was that,
yeah.
was that I wouldn't be able to contact him unless it was going to be a book. Not that that I wouldn't have a good excuse, right?
Yes.
Is that the question you were asking?
Just to a certain degree, but I think it also. I'm curious. Let's say you didn't track him down. Would you have been able to finish the book?
Yeah, because in a way I didn't find him, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I found out more about him, and I found out where he might be, and I found out a little bit more since the book came out. But it's not like we got to sit down and have our nice heart-to-heart conversation like I always wanted, you know?
Yeah.
We didn't get to have that at all. I think in the book I even list questions that I would ask him if I could. And in earlier versions of the book, I had additional questions that I would ask him. Like there's a moment in the book where I'm talking to a feminist in Nicaragua, and she's telling me that she invented soccer. And he's all annoyed about the fact that she said that he invented it, and they're arguing about it. And in an earlier version of the book, I had myself saying, I wish so much that I could ask George if he remembers that, because it's still so vivid in my mind, that argument, and I thought it was so funny, and he was so annoyed by it. I wish so much I could just ask him, do you remember that? That was so, you know, like you could just sort of sit around, you know, with your old friend from high school or something and be like, hey, remember that? Let's have another beer and talk about it. And I'd never be able to have that conversation with him, and that's sad to me.
On the other hand, sometimes when you do run into someone from high school and it turns out you have nothing in common with that person too, sometimes that unfortunately happens. And then sometimes with other people, it's like you hadn't seen each other for years and you connect just like that, so you never know. I, the other question that we didn't really touch
upon.
That's true,
and I like that. I love, that's yeah. one thing that's really nice about not,
yeah.
about George not contacting me or wanting to talk to me, is that now I can always have that romantic image in my mind. It'll never be ruined because he'll never be able to be some boring guy who I don't have anything in common with anymore.
Yeah. Well, what would be the first question you would ask George if he were sitting here right now? Only one.
Oh, that's a terrible restriction. I guess I would ask him if he likes the portrayal of himself in the book, if he thought it was at all accurate.
Huh. The betrayal over how are you doing? Or do you feel that he's part of the past of your life, so you don't really need to know who he is in the present?
Oh, I would also really want to know who he is now. I guess
yeah.
that if I could, I would ask him that about the betrayal. But if I could talk to him more, I would ask him, you know, who he is now. What's he doing today? Yeah, I guess that maybe that would probably be the first question. And the second question is, what does he think of the betrayal?
And there's one other question I had in that big cluster, shortly around the photographs. Why does it have to be George as opposed to anybody who has that revolutionary spirit inside? I mean, tracking him down specifically, it seems to me, have something to do with the need to chronicle the unique voice. But I'm wondering why an approximation of that voice, like, say, talking to somebody else who was there at that time doing something similar, isn't enough for you.
Well, because the book is really sort of about George. I mean, it's about George more than it is even, in some ways, about me. I mean, I guess it is just as much about me. Maybe about equal.
Yeah.
So it wouldn't feel nearly as urgent to me to talk to just somebody who had been there at that time. It's a very personal book.
Yeah. Oh, interesting. Would you say that you have more lasting urgencies in nonfiction than you do with fiction?
No, because my fiction is always about it's about my life.
Yeah.
Or about questions that I have about the world. It's about philosophical and moral questions.
Well, on that note, Deb, thanks very much. It was a pleasure chatting with you.
Thank you so much. This was great.
Fantastic. Cool.